Welcome to episode number 8 of The Zach Kuhn Show. My guest today is Robert Deaton, the executive producer behind the CMA Awards as well as the Billboard Awards. In addition, Robert also produces the CMA Country Christmas Special as well as the CMA Fest Music Special, which he also created. We talk all about that. In the beginning of his career, Robert produced some of the most iconic music videos of all time for artists like Rascal Flatts, Martina McBride, Big and Rich, Dolly Parton, Waylon Jennings, Brad Paisley, Carrie Underwood. I mean, the list is insane. Today, Robert manages one of the fastest rising acts in Nashville, King Calloway. We talk all about that as well. There is so much to hear. I want to stop talking. Let's just dive into it. Okay, Robert, we are live on the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's good to spend some time with you today.
Absolutely. So I was going down a big rabbit hole of your music videos. I mean, the list is insane. It's hundreds. I was watching a ton of them. You know, one of the ones that I didn't realize that you had worked on is the Justin Bieber Rascal Flatts one, That Should Be Me. Do you remember this video? Because this was so early in Justin's career. Did you know he was going to become such a big star?
Yeah, oh no. He was, yes, everybody knew he was going to be a big star. And he was already kind of a big star even then. I remember that day because there was the big, huge controversy on the shoot that day because he wanted to cut his hair. You know, the hair's was the signature. You know what I'm remember?
Right.
Remember the Justin Bieber hair? And it was like this whole thing going around. He wanted to cut it. Nobody wanted him to cut it. And then he cut it and put it, and then he put it out on, you know, on socials, and people went berserk and crazy, and all that was happening that day. And it was just, that's one thing that I remember of that video shoot. That was fun. And then, you know what? I got to work with him. You know, I've worked with him several times since then, for performances on the Billboard Music Awards. So, it was always great to work with him, actually.
I've always heard that he's the most professional. Is that the case? I've always heard he nails it every time. He's just the best.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know what? I've heard stories of things, you know, people that have had issues, and honestly, I've never had any. He's always been great to me, and he's always been awesome. You know, he's always been real polite, and you know, always on time, and always came prepared. We always got along really good, and hopefully, you know, we'll get to work together again in the future. But you know what? It was funny. One time for dress, the last time I worked with him for dress rehearsals, he was late, just by a little bit, not much. And we went ahead with the performance because there was dancers and all this stuff. And he literally got to the stage like a minute and a half late, and I stopped dress, which is something that you don't ever do normally. You normally
right.
don't ever start to dress unless you absolutely have to. And so I stopped dress, and we redid the number, and you know, so that he could rehearse it one more time. And after the dress rehearsal, he actually came to me and said, "Man, thanks so much for stopping dress for me. You know, I just appreciate it." And I'm like, "Man, I want you to be able." First of all, it was no big deal. Secondly, I just wanted you to have another run through of, you know, a rehearsal to make sure that you were comfortable and you had, you know, all the dance steps down and everything was good for you, you know? And, you know, he was incredibly polite, and, you know, he's always been a good guy to me. So I always enjoy working with him.
That's awesome. So I'm so excited to talk with you right now because it's such an interesting time for content creation. And you're like the content king. I mean, going back to the 90s, it feels like you did every music video for every country artist, hundreds. And then, of course, you know, the Billboard Awards, the CMA Awards, CMA Fest, you know, everything. So right now, I mean, we're at such a, you know, our resources for content creation are so limited.
I love what your band King Calloway is doing, where they're like the Nashville house band. But how are you thinking about content right now, and taking advantage of the resources that we have for content?
Well, I have happened to be in a situation where, you know, I've had two shows that I have had one show that's canceled with the CMA Music Festival because there's no way to, you know, there's no way to do that show any other way than how we do it.
Right.
Because the fact of the matter is the CMA Festival is not the festival without the fans. The people that come and from all over the world and spend their money and drive in and fly in and you bust in, however they get here, you know, they are what makes the festival special. It's unlike anything in the world. And so we knew that we could not replicate that in any way. So we had to, unfortunately, we had to cancel that show. My other show, Billboard Music Awards, you know, that was already supposed to have happened. We postponed it, and we are looking at a different date. And we're not sure when that date is and when we're going to do it. But then I have upcoming the CMA Awards and the CMA Christmas show. And right now what we're doing is, you know, we're coming up with Plan B, you know, on all the shows. 'Cause you have to. You know, we hope that we're going to be able to do the Christmas show just like we have done it in the past. And we're certainly hopeful that we can do the CMA Awards in November, just like what we always do. Just thinking, you know, our intention is to, you know, everything is we're moving forward just like what we always do. But, you know, we're also at the same time smart to be able to, you know, come up with other contingencies. You have to. I think everybody's having to do that. But right now we are full bore, you know, straight ahead. We are doing the awards and we're doing the Christmas show just like we always have done. And then hopefully there'll be some kind of incarnation of the Billboard Music Awards too. Hopefully we'll get another date, get an arena, and we will, we'll be just like we are. Just, you know, several months later. But we're also looking at other ideas. But you know what? For tentpole events, you know, some of these shows you just can't do in a living room. You know, you can't do it. I feel like some of the things that have been really entertaining has been like, for example, the Disney shows that have been on ABC. And they're getting ready to do another one. I mean, that's a great format because it works in a living room. It works with family. You know, when you see Little Big Town doing Spoonful of Sugar and Kimberly's baking in her kitchen, that's great creative, you know. And the songs work, and, you know, everybody knows those songs, which is a great format. That format works.
And the Opry's been doing a great job also with it, I feel like.
Well, you know what? Honest, 100%. So proud of what the Opry is doing. It's hard to do, you know. They've kept it, you know, I think they're doing those shows with 10 people in the Opry House. So what they've been able to do has been unbelievable. And it's so good. If people haven't watched it online, or it's so good. The first one with Vince and
with his whole family, it was incredible.
Oh, it was just so good. You know, the one with Vince and Brad and Marty was so. They've been able to do a really great job, you know. And as far as, we are wrapping our heads around how do we deliver the creative differently? How do we do things that are different for people? But, you know, hopefully for us, you know, CMA Awards are November. Hopefully that, you know, we can provide everybody a show that is not too different than what we do. And but you know, just like everybody else, we're keeping our ears to the ground because right now nobody knows. I mean,
totally.
Again, I mean, you read the news, nobody knows. I mean, the Predators don't know if they're going to be playing hockey. You know, UT, we don't know. You know, college football, nobody knows. NFL, nobody knows. So what we have to do is, you know, like the NBA. The NBA is putting together 3 and 4 different scenarios of how they could possibly resume the season, and they don't know which direction they're going to go. So right now the idea is just to try to be prepared and try to it's a lot of work that's never going to come to fruition. But right now what you have to do is just go, okay, so this is what we want to do. This is plan B. This is plan C. You know, and you just have to keep going. In regards to King Callaway, the band, you know, we looked at the space going, you know, that was interesting how all that, the house band series was created, the King Callaway house band.
Right.
Because what happened was, you know, the guys really do come from the call, they're cut from, now, understand what I'm saying. I'm not saying they're as good as Keith Urban, okay, because there's not anybody as good as Keith Urban and Vince Gill and those guys. But they are cut from the same cloth, those guys are. They are, you know, you don't become that proficient in your instrument if you don't love music and you don't love musicians. And they do. And they love whenever they get to sit in with people. You know, the second time they ever were on the Opry, you know, they asked Ricky Dax to be a part of their set. They did Seven Bridges Road. They are literally cut of the same cloth as Vince and Ricky and Keith Urban in that they want to play with other people and of all genres. And what happened was we did a the guys did a their current single is No Matter What. You know, they're right now they're in 3 different countries. They're in Gibraltar, Jordan's in Gibraltar, Jordan's in Scotland, Simon is in Gibraltar, Chad's in Nashville. No, Chad's in LA, Chris is in Nashville, Caleb's in Ohio.
God, there's so many, you can't keep it straight.
I know, and Austin is in Florida. So there's 6 of them. So they're in different places. So they did the current single is No Matter What, and they did a, you know, in your living room type performance that honestly, it was stellar. I mean, and they are stellar. I mean, their musicians is stellar, and how they put it out. And literally, we got a call from Jimmy Allen, or I didn't. You know, we didn't. I'll just say that. What happened was Jimmy Allen called Chris and was like, man, that thing you did for No Matter What is awesome on your socials. And just the sound and how you did it. And how do you do this when you're in 3 different countries, you know? And so Chris kind of explained to him their process and how they went about – it takes about a week to do. And
wow.
How they went about doing it. And so Jimmy was like, hey, let's do one together. And they loved Jimmy to death. And so they're like, yeah. So they did Hooked on a Feeling. And then we put Hooked on a Feeling out, and it got a lot of hits on socials and a lot of people reposting it. And, you know, like iHeart reposted it. And, you know, they put it – there's a Country Weekly, you know, said something about it. It's just started, you know, so we started thinking about going back to who they want to be and who, you know, and how they want to be, how they want to play with all different kinds of artists and from all genres. And so we came up with this platform called King Callaway's House Band Series. And it is, and it's, you know what, it's about connecting with other artists and connecting to the fans and playing music that people remember and people love. And, you know, right now, if you look at, like, for example, there's been all these articles on, like, on Wall Street Journal and what people, all this, streaming services, you know, they're up because people are finding the comfort music, which is what they're calling it, comfort music. Something
right.
that you love, that you grew up, kind of like the soundtracks of your life, you know, kind of thing. And so we thought, well, let's just have some fun with it. And let's redo some of these great songs and have fun with it and invite artists to participate and play music together. And so the second one we did was with Waiting on the World to Change with Blanco and Jimmy Allen, Lindsay L. The third one was Lindsey Sterling, the great EDM violinist who's just insanely creative, and Sarah Evans doing Come On Eileen. And then we reached across the pond with the Shires doing Miley Cyrus' The Climb. And then this past week we had Kaylee Hammock doing
Fleetwood Mac, right? They were doing Rihanna,
yeah,
I think.
Fleetwood Mac, yeah, which was stunning. And each one gets a little bit better because I think each one they start figuring out how to record it better in their living room and how it sounds better. And so it's just really, that whole series is really kind of taken off for the guys. And it's really been able to, you know, because they're a brand, they're a new act. I would still consider them a new act. And this summer was, King Calloway was scheduled to open for Rascal Flatts on their farewell tour, and they were going to do all these festivals, and people were going to really get to see what musicians they are and how great they are live. And then all of a sudden, over a period of a month, all of that was gone. And so this series has been able to really showcase the guys, people in a big space are able to see, wow, this King Calloway, they are really great players. So it's worked really, really good. And it's also been able to connect them to some of their heroes and artists that they love to play with.
And I think, you know, watching them do, I feel like when this first happened, everyone sort of didn't know what to do. Everything was very point and shoot. It was like, let's just put up an iPhone, go live. And now people are starting to figure it out. And it's really cool to see what they're doing because it feels like they're really being creative with it and, you know, taking it to another place.
Well, I appreciate that. And I know that they will too. And I'm going to pass that along to them. I do feel like that this situation of having to play like this is, you use the old term, separates the men from the boys. For example, take an artist like Keith Urban and you go, wow, it's just you when you strip it down, he's still great, and it's like, and it's just him on guitar, and it's just pretty amazing. And I saw a thing, I think it was Ashley McBride, where it was like, you go, wow, what, just guitar and vocal, what a great vocalist she is, and it's just like, so I think it separates some people sometimes, where it's like, this is not optimum, but you know what, the cream does rise to the top because, it's like I said, three people on stage with Vince Gill and Marty Stewart and Brad Paisley, and it's like amazing. Or just look at what Brad Paisley's doing on his socials. It's like, wow, so it's able to showcase, I think, the musicians, which I think is really, it's really nice because that's what makes great music are great musicians.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go back for a minute. So, you're from North Carolina originally. In the 90s, I mentioned it earlier, you were really like the driving force of music video creation. But to the best of my knowledge, like, you really didn't go to college to study film. Like, how did you land in that position? How did you get to that place?
Yeah, so you know what? What happened was, and before I get into that, I want to make sure I give people understand that I give a shout out to my dearest friend and brother, George Flanagan. Because George and I were business partners, and we had a company called Deep Flanagan Productions, and we did 300-400 music videos together. So, you know, I always wanted to be in entertainment. You know, I always wanted to be in some. You know, I loved television, photography, audio. You know, growing up in high school, I had a band. You know, that we played clubs, and then I did plays and musicals, and you know, I just loved show business. I just always wanted to put on a show. You know, I didn't care what the medium was. It was like whether I was playing trumpet in an orchestra, you know, or in a play, or doing photography, whatever it was that was creative. And the day after graduation, high school graduation, I packed my bag, packed my car, and I drove to Nashville. And I thought in the beginning I was going to be an audio engineer. And then in the way of, through audio engineering, getting into producing records. And because, you know, I studied music my whole life. I played in, my instrument was trumpet, and I played in orchestras in and around my hometown of Fayetteville, North Carolina. And
geographically closest to Nashville. Is that the reason Nashville. You chose Nashville, or did you always think Nashville versus
my father was in a television station in Wilmington, North Carolina, WECT TV6, and he had several shows on the air, but one was a Friday night country music show. So all the artists, all the Grand Ole Opry stars of the day used to come to his show. And so I met, you know, all those Opry stars of the day, you know, and would come and I was a part of the show as well, because it was very much Grand Ole Opry like, but originating from Wilmington, North Carolina. They had the square dancers and all that, and I was one of the square dancers. I was 6 years old, and you know, every week we were doing this show, and then my dad had some, you know, and he was in Nashville for a while and playing in. You know, he had an act that, you know, traveled the country with his band and had a few singles out. Never really any success single-wise, but he did write a hit record for Jack Green and Jeannie Seeley. And so Nashville was always a part of, you know, country music, and was always a part of my DNA growing up. So here comes graduation. I think I want to be an audio engineer. And then through audio engineering, get into record producing. So I moved to Nashville for a specific reason. It was a guy at the time, a guy named Johnny Rosen, and he had a company called Fanta Sound. And he no longer has that company, and he works out at Cumberland Heights. And he was at the time he was teaching as a professor at Vanderbilt University. And you could take those classes without actually having to, quote unquote, enroll at Vanderbilt. So on the back of all my albums, all my live albums, Rolling Stones records, I mean, just every single live album that you could possibly ever have, it was always recorded by Johnny Rosen for Fanta Sound. So I'm like, if I want to be a sound engineer, that's where I need to
that's
go.
That's the guy.
That's the guy. And I can go study from him. So I came and enrolled on all those classes, And I remember, and so Johnny would also do remotes, like, still, he was still working in the business, and Johnny would always take two students with him as part of, you know, to get, gain experience and all that kind of stuff. So I remember there was, it's like the fifth week I was there, and Johnny's like, okay, I got another, you know, I got a gig this Thursday. I take two students, and I'm going to change something here. But and so Johnny was just honest as the day is long. And he said, and he goes, here's the thing I'm going to make. It's going to be a slight difference. Robert Deaton is going to take one slot for the rest of the slots. And he goes, because he's actually going to be in this business. That's exactly what he said.
What do you think he saw in you?
You know what? I think he just saw how eager I was. You know, I ate it up. You know, I loved every minute. I've never wanted to do anything else but be in, to be in entertainment. You know, I just wanted to entertain people, and I just loved every aspect of it. And so I started going on all the remotes, and then, you know, after about, I don't know, a year, I was doing that for a while, and then I started getting some, because I studied still photography as well, I started getting some calls to be a cameraman on some local productions, just running camera, shooting bands, you know, doing all that kind of stuff. At some point in time, I had to make a decision. At the beginning, you got to kind of decide what's the direction, you know, and what do I have to do and to be successful. And so I decided, you know what? I decided, you know, I think I'm going to go down the television route. Never forgetting, though, that I wanted to someday get back into the music side. And it took me longer to kind of get back into the music side than I thought. But I thought, you know, if I can be successful on the TV side, then one day I want to open back up this other creative side that I love, which is music and audio and all that. So I started getting hired, you know, doing more and more freelance as a cameraman, then started getting some directorial. People started hiring me to direct. These were just small, little, you know, shooting bands, just doing whatever. Sometimes you get paid, you know, pizza. You know, it's like,
right,
we don't have any money, but after the gig, we'll all order a pizza. It's like, I didn't care. It was like, I just wanted to do it. It was like, plus I love the camaraderie of the crews and you know, I just loved every bit of it. I didn't care. I've been so, if I made $100, then great. If I didn't, then that's okay too. I just felt like that the more I did that, you know, I just wasn't thinking about how much money I was going to make at the time. I was just wanting to work. And so after a while, so then I got a job offer at WKRN Channel 2, and I took that job, and I worked in marketing and promotion. And that was great because it just gave me I was able to shoot more and able to craft these promos and shoot them, and I was able to you know, come up with the concepts. And around the second year that I was at Channel 2, that's when I met George Flanagan. And I met him on a freelance shoot. He shooting some kind of band. I don't remember who it was. I do remember, I think the guy had a snake, though, the performer. I do remember that. And I remember, you know, there's a button on your camera where you can see the return, which is the program. Return is like the program. So you can see the program.
Sure.
And then you let the button go to see what you're shooting. And I was, you know, you always toggle back and forth to Jersey, and I kept watching. Every time I go back to it, I'd see George's shot, and I'd be like, yeah, that's, he knows what he's doing. And it, and I'm competitive. So that, so I wanted to, you know, I wanted to be the best. And so
right.
It just up my game. It's like, oh, okay, you're going to shoot that? Okay, this is what I'm shooting. Okay, this is what you didn't see. And then I'd toggle back, and he'd have another great shot. I'm like, going, okay, this, okay. And then so I, so that was the first day that we met. And then after a couple of months, I got asked to do a documentary in Israel on a Christian artist by the name of Sandy Patty, who was at the time the biggest Christian artist in the industry. And I asked George to come be on the crew. And then I started, and then at the same time, I started being asked to do some music videos in the Christian world. And so, George and I started doing those together. And out of that, we decided to start a company. And it was a minute before we could, before we got a country thing. We did a bunch of stuff in the Christian world, which was great because it was, we were able to learn the craft, and we did stuff for like DeGarmo and Key, DC Talk, a lot of the contemporary Christian, which were big acts, ended up being big acts in the Christian world. And we were, but we knew we were trying to get into country. And,
now, what was, I mean, you just said you were trying to get into country. What was, did you have sort of a big dream? Did you know that the, you know, producer of the CMA Awards was a thing that you could shoot for? Or were you just trying to, you know, create as much videos with as many artists as possible?
No, we had, CMA Awards wasn't even in the, in view, was not even in view. Now, I always loved the CMA Awards, and I remember watching it as a kid, you know, and I would watch it every year and root for Kenny Rogers or who, you know, whoever was up, you know, I'd root for certain acts. I remember when I was hoping the Gambler won so badly that year, you know, and so I always watched it, but no, so we wanted to break, we definitely wanted to break into the country music because it was the beginning of the business. And I felt like, you know, when you get in the ground floor, getting in the, on the ground floor of a business is a good idea, you know? And so it took a minute. And I remember, so really, the, here's what the catalyst was. Eddie DeGarmo, he was one half of DeGarmo and Key. Big, huge, successful Christian duo. They he did a solo project, and on that record was a song called Feels Good to Be Forgiven, which is a very bluesy, kind of country blues kind of song. And so I called their manager and said, you know, let's do a video on this song. Because I felt like that the song could possibly get on CMT. And, you know, CMT was at the very beginning of CMT. I think they were still in Hendersonville. It was very small, but I thought, you know, this could get on CMT, and which would be good for us, for George and I. And so we did the video. I think it was a $4,000 budget, and I think we came in at $5,000. I actually lost $1,000 on it.
Wow.
You know, but everybody got paid. And so it was interesting because not only did all the gospel stations pick it up, but so did BET Entertainment, and so did CMT. And there was a guy at the time, it was Columbia and Epic, a guy named James Carlson, who was head of the video department, and he called a guy named Jeff Walker, who started Aristo Media, and said, I just saw a video on there on CMT by Eddie DeGarmo. And he said, Jeff Walker goes, James, that's the two guys I've been telling you about. for the last 3 months. They are Nashville's best kept secret. And he goes, well, he goes, give me their number. And Jeff Walker, who passed away a couple of years, 3 years ago, maybe something like 4 years ago, could be longer. He was so good to us, always trying to promote George and I. He had a company and they promoted singles, they promoted videos. And he was just our torchbearer. You know, I'm not sitting here talking to you today without Jeff Walker. And so Jeff was like, that's the guy, that's who I'm telling you. So Jeff called, I answered the phone, and he goes, I saw your, James called, James said, I saw the video, and I'd love to talk to you about doing a video for us. And I'm like, absolutely. This was, I mean, can you imagine? I mean, this was the break, you know, this was the,
right.
You know, this is the break. This is it. This is it. A major label, Columbia Records, Epic Records. Are you?
This is the pinnacle.
This is the pinnacle. When the check comes in, it'll have Columbia Records on the check. I mean, come on.
You can't even cash that. That's for the wall.
No, exactly. Because I'm the kid that saved every 45. And my dad, was at the beginning of his career, was a DJ, and he'd bring records home. And I would look at those records forever, those 45 of Decca and MCA and ABC Dot and, you know, RCA with the dog. I mean, I would look at those, and it was just, to me, it was magic. And so this is the call. And I said, well, when? And he goes, how about right now? And I'm like, we're coming over right now. And I remember getting in the car and driving to the, you know, to Auburn 16th Avenue and it was just the day. It was the day. And he goes, I love your work and blah, blah, blah. I want to hire you for, you can do it for this amount. I think it was $30,000. I mean, it was a big budget to us, you know, at the time. And it was Shelby Lynn. It was Shelby Lynn was the first country artist that we ever worked with, and that was what started our James Carlson is another one. Just was huge to impact in our career. He worked with us. It was probably about a year and a half, 2 years before we worked with another label. So about a year and a half, everything that we did was with James and Sony. It wasn't even Sony at the time. It was Epic and Columbia. And then about a year and a half later, Mary Hamilton, who was over at RCA, hired us to do a couple of videos over at RCA. And then once we got that, then we were off to the races. And then we started working with everybody.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening and hope you're enjoying the show. Some of you may know that I run an industry newsletter called the Nashville Briefing. Really takes you to the front row of everything happening in our industry. And if you want to learn more about it, you can go to nashvillebriefing.com to subscribe. Also, if you're enjoying this show and specifically this episode, please feel free to give us a 5-star review on your podcast listening platform. Thanks so much. Now back to the show.
So you're working with so many people, many of which are rising up at the moment, but you also, I mean, you worked with Dolly in the 90s. She was still a massive star. You're working with everyone. Are you ever getting starstruck? And you would go on to work with, you know, the biggest celebrities, not just in country music, but in music period. Do you ever get starstruck around these people?
Yeah, well, I will tell not anymore, but then, you know what? When you're someone who grew up idolizing all these people in country music, and you knew, I was the kid that knew every player on every record, and I can still tell you who played on what record, or who was in Elvis's band. You know, but there are a few moments where you go, like I remember the first time I'm at my desk, and I get my assistant. Says, Dolly Parton is on the line for you. And that was the first call, you know, and it was like, literally, my hands were shaking to pick up the phone, you know, just literally shaking. Or, you know, when Chet Atkins called you. So I remember another time when I was
Did Chet ever call you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have here the story. I mean, what happened?
Well, Chet was our neighbor across the street. We were on 17th, and he was our neighbor across the street. But we had also done a couple of music videos for him. We did The Claw, Jerry Reed. Jerry Reed, Chet Atkins together. I mean, they redid The Claw with Chet on it, and so we did that music video, and like, you know, driving into the shoot that day, knowing that you're shooting Jerry Reed and Chet Atkins was just, you know, and I can tell you that even right now I get emotional just even thinking about it, just thinking about me as like this kid that was going in. But the good thing for me that I was never lost on the moment, you know, I was always very grateful. You know, and I understood that I was going in to shoot Jerry Reed and Chet Atkins when it was that, or if I was going in to work with Waylon. You know, Waylon became a very good and close friend of ours, you know. And so just to get a call from Waylon to go, what are you doing? Nothing, what's happening? He goes, come down here, I want you to play some music. And, you know, he was down the street from our office, so we'd get in there, you know, we'd walk down and go hang with him for a couple of hours. I don't remember if you know the Honky Tonk Angels. Remember that? The Honky Tonk Angels was Loretta, Tammy.
Right.
Tammy and Dolly. And we did the music video. This is a funny story. So in that, the song, it was Silver Threads and Golden Needles. And the whole concept was all these big, huge are trying to, they're bringing gifts and presents to their dressing room, trying to get in, but they keep slamming the door. So on all these artists until Chet gets there, and they welcome Chet with open arms. It's really cute, funny, and everybody was in it. I mean, we're talking Carl Perkins. You know, it was just like this huge group of. Like it's basically the Hall of Fame. So we're shooting at Tennessee Performing Arts Center, and all of a sudden there's the fire alarm goes off. Well, the security comes down to where we're shooting and go, hey, we have to evacuate to outside the building. I'm like, wait, what? Are you kidding me? I mean, no. He's like, no, you have to evacuate. Everybody's got to go stand on the sidewalk. I said, will you look around here for a second? I've got the Hall of Fame sit, you know, here.
This is like the correspondence dinner. Like, if that building blows up, it's all of country.
It's crazy. Yeah, it was crazy to think of all the art. Ricky Skaggs, for example. I mean, it was like Loretta, Tammy, Dolly, Chet Atkins, you know, Ronnie Millsap. And so we that's what we did. We went outside, and everybody, I told the security guard, I said, there's going to be an accident because people are not watching where they're going. You've got to let us back into the building. I mean, it was hilarious. All these people standing out there. It was like, it was surreal. I mean, it was like, you look back on it, and I've been so blessed, you know, to be able to work with heroes. I'll tell you a regret that I had. Waylon called George and I when they were cutting the second Highwaymen album. And Don Was producing, and he's like, hey, what are you doing? And I'm like, got a couple of video shoots coming up. And he's like, hey, come down here and why don't you come down and hang with us, you know, while we record this record. Come out and hang for a week. it's Willie and I and John and Chris are all here and you know, all the Outlaws, they really kind of died out. I have to tell you, at the time, we didn't know Willie. No, we knew Willie very well. I didn't know Cash that well.
Sure.
All the Outlaws, I mean, we did all the Outlaw stuff, and so they were friends of ours, and they were like, come in with us, and we didn't go, because we were working, and it was like, you always, you know, you kind of, that was the one regret, because I thought, you know, there'll be another day on that, and
wow.
It just was. But I will tell you, my greatest compliment was, you know, we won CMA Awards for Independence Day. We won for Believe with Brooks and Dunn, and we were nominated for at least over 10 times throughout the career. The greatest compliment was when Waylon passed away. I got a call about a week later, maybe 2 weeks. It was within 2 weeks for sure. And it was Shooter, Waylon's son.
Right.
And Shooter goes, hey, Robert, we're doing a memorial service. Dad and Mom, Jesse, Mom wanted to know if we'd like to do a video tribute to Dad, and Mom wanted to know if you would do it, and if you and George would do it. And I was like, of course, absolutely. Shooter said, well, we're glad that you will do it. The Mom said, if you couldn't do it, then we just weren't going to do a video tribute, because would have only approved of you doing it.
Wow.
And so, to this day, that's the greatest compliment that, that we ever had. And it's, you know what, honestly, too, it's always been the big connection between us and Hank Jr. You know, we did Monday Night Football opens for 7 years with Hank. But what drew us close together with Hank was Hank knew that Waylon loved George and I. And so that's why whenever Hank did a video or music video or Monday Night Football or whatever it was, we were the call. We were the only call. In fact, the label told Hank one time, said, "We're going to get some treatments in from production companies for your next video for you to look at." And he's like, "Well, that's fine. You can do that all you want, but I'm just going to tell you right now, Deacon Flanagan's doing the video, so you can waste your time or you cannot." So
they're the guys.
We're the guys. We were the guys. And you know, it's funny too, because you know, it's like those outlaw type artists, you know, because we did the whole run with the Music Mafia. Everything Gretchen Wilson did, everything Big and Rich did, you know, we did that whole run too. So
I mean, the Save a Horse, Ride a Cowboy video, I mean, it's iconic. It's the best.
Yeah, it's pretty iconic. It was. Of course, everybody reminds us on that video that we were in the news the next week because we damaged the pedestrian bridge. So that's all right. You know what? It's an iconic video. So, you know what? It's that was a great that part of the career. That was great. I mean, we were flying everywhere. We were working. We were somewhere. I mean, we were in our early 20s, and we were blowing and going. I mean, we were doing, 20 clips a year. We were doing Monday Night Football. We were doing, music videos for everybody, for the legends like Dolly.
Were they, I mean, the budgets were obviously big because this is the peak of country music. By the time the video shot and the budget's over, was this a lucrative business to be in at the time, at the end of the day, once everything was done?
That's the difference. That's the difference. It was a business you could be in, and it was lucrative. By the time we were at the highest part, we were getting $300,000 to $500,000 per video.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and so... and then even then, you still, getting, even the low ones were 150, 200 grand. And so back then it was, there was several of us. There was a handful of us that's how we made our living. It's almost impossible to do as a director to just solely make a living just doing music videos anymore, because there's just, you know, the budgets are too low and there's too many people doing it. You can't spread it out over 30 to 50 directors and think that you're going to make a living. It was definitely the golden age, you know, for sure. And it was fun, but you gotta evolve. I mean, that was the thing that I've always tried to do. You try to evolve. And if you don't evolve, you stand still, it's going to be over.
Right. So you end up, and I'm hoping this is next in the timeline, you, which I didn't realize, actually created the CMA Fest special. So
I did.
Like, did you sneak into Nissan with cameras? Like how did you piece that together and see that opportunity?
So that was a situation where finally, after the third try, I finally got on the CMA board. And one thing that's going to be a through line, that you can tell through this conversation, is nobody ever gets anywhere without help. And I don't care who you are, you got to have people that are your champions. And I get a call from Kitty Moon. Kitty Moon is a great, great woman in this industry who was so influential to every single thing. If you're living in Nashville, if you live in Nashville, you have been affected by Kitty Moon, because she was so involved in the city and the planning, and she owned a production company called Scene 3 at the time. She called me and she said, hey, I'm going to nominate you for the board. And I'm like, Kitty, I've been nominated twice and it hadn't happened. She's like, I promise you, this time you're going to be on the board. And I'm like, okay, we'll try it. Well, I got on the board. And so after I got on the board, I got put on the TV committee. And then after a while of being on the TV committee, they made me the chairman of the TV committee. So, you know, but when I got on the board, I started looking around, you know, it's like everybody, Joe Galani, Tim Dubois, you know, it was the who's who of the best and brightest in Nashville was on that board. And I basically looked around and going, all right, well, what? How do I contribute to this? So I thought, like, well, I'll contribute with what's my area of expertise. And so I thought, well, I'll contribute by trying to get the CMA Music Festival as a television show. That's going to be my contribution. And so what I did was, that year, and it's interesting too, because, you know, at one point, the festival almost went away. You know, there was a time right near the tail of it, being at the fairgrounds, where people were wondering, is this going to continue? And then I remember we had a board meeting in Beverly Hills, at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and there was going to be a vote about whether we were going to continue with the festival. And you know what? It was not sure how that vote was going to come out. But we voted to continue with the festival, but move it and start and move it to the stadium. And so we did that. We did a name change from Fanfare to CMA Music Fest. And I believe it was the second year that we were at the festival. I went down and shot the festival myself. Just me by myself, handheld camera, and I put together okay?
Wait, literally you, yeah. Like not your team. Just like me. It was just you.
Just me. Nobody else. Just me. I went down with a camera and I shot for 4 days. And I, out of that 4 days, I took, put together and I found that reel, I think I found it, but it was missing for a while, but which probably should be in the Country Music Hall of Fame. But I shot like a 4 minute, 5 minute sizzle piece of what the festival is. Because you can't describe what the festival is. You can't write it, what a festival is. So I put together that 5 minute piece, and I, myself, Ed Benson, and Joel Katz went to CBS, and we met with Les Moonves, and I showed him the clip, and he bought the special. And the first year we were on CBS, people don't remember this, first year we were on CBS, I think we got like 16 million viewers that first year, which was insane. Wish we had those numbers now.
Were you surprised that he said yes, or did you think it was in the bag?
Well, I had pitched other shows before and never sold anything, and then it was like we all got in the elevator after we met with Les for about 45 minutes and was like, wow, that was easy. I mean, it was like, I don't know if I knew it was in the bag or not, but I knew it was good. We first year was on CBS. The second year, even though we got great numbers, I think we finished like, I don't know where we finished, but it was one of the top shows of the week. CBS didn't want to do the show again, not because of the rating, but because he was like, I can put a rerun of whatever, one of their procedurals, and get the same rating. I don't have to pay anything for it. Well, you can't necessarily deny the business part of that. But we were like, wow, we did really well. And so as soon as they said they were going to do it, ABC almost immediately said that they wanted it. And that's what got ABC in the country music business. And then eventually ABC got the awards. So that was all, yeah. Who knows where we would be today and how that history would have changed had I not gone down and shot for 4 days at the CMA Music Festival.
Okay, so how do you get the call to produce the CMA Awards? Now it kind of seems like everything's building up to it, but how do you actually get that call?
Well, it was interesting because I had put together the idea and the creative and the concept of the festival and shot it, did not necessarily mean that I was going to produce that show. So what happened was, because I was still the chairman of the TV committee, so we got into a room, TV committee had a meeting, and again, it was all, you know, the big wigs of the industry at the time. And I remember this to this day because I was going, you know, they wanted me to go out to L.A. and interview some producers and directors. And, you know, which was fine, which was great, which is that's what the plan was. The plan was I was going to go out, interview some producers and directors to attach them to do the show. And so I did. I went out to L.A.,
Is this the award show or is this the festival?
This is the festival.
The festival. Got it.
Yeah, because it was not a given that I would produce it. That was not because I had done music videos up until that point.
Right.
I had never done a network television show. So I went out to L.A. and who we were trying to get to produce the show passed on it. And he's a legend, and I love him dearly. And he's still producing to this day. He's a great producer. But the one thing that I did get out of it is that I met a director that I really wanted to do the show. And it was a very outside-the-box idea, because it was a guy named Gary Halverson, and Gary, at the time, was the number one, at least in the top three, of sitcom directors. He directed Friends and Everybody Loves Raymond and Two and a Half Men, and he was one of the best of the best. But his how he started was in music. He directed just a lot of different music programs, and he had decided that he wanted to get back into music, and one of the shows that he produced or directed was one of the Faith Hill specials that I really loved, and I thought it was great. So I called Gary Borman, Keith's manager, and he says, "Gary, it's Gary Halverson. He's brilliant. You should meet with him when you're in L.A., blah, blah, blah." So I met with him in L.A., and I'm like going, this is the guy. This is the guy, because I could tell he loves music. I found out later he studied at Juilliard. He was originally going to be a pianist, realized that he was not in the top 1%, so he ended up at PBS directing Sesame Street and doing some music projects. And so today he is now like the premier television director for opera and classical music. He does all the Fathom events for the Metropolitan Opera. So I came back to the TV committee, said, I think I found a director, but the producer we want wanted, he's passed on it. And so Larry Fitzgerald, who manages Vince Gill to this day, and he at the time he was managing Brad Paisley, a bunch of different artists, he raised his hand and he said, "I got a problem I got a problem." And everybody's like, "Whoa, wait, what?" You know, because he's serious about this. And he goes, "I just got a problem with this whole thing." He goes, "You know what? I just don't think it's fair. I don't think what we're doing is fair." He goes, "I don't think it's fair to Robert that he is, it's just been his idea, his baby, and it has been, he went and shot the sizzle and went and pre-pitched the Les Moonves and sold the show, and I think that he ought to be able to produce it."
Wow.
And so the committee, and they asked, so the guys on the committee said, and Connie Bradley was on the committee and said, "Do you want to do it?" And I'm like, "I would love to do it. I'd love to produce this show." And so they excused me for the room for about 20 minutes and then asked me to come back in and said, "You're the producer of the show." And that's how I got my first producing. That's how I was able to start my producing career of big network television.
Wow.
And
did you feel the pressure or were you pretty confident that you'd be able to pull it off?
I did not feel the pressure. No, I felt here's the thing. If I knew then what I know now, knowing that we greenlit the show and had to be up and ready in less than a month, I would have been like freaking out. But I didn't know that then. You know what? Stupidity is good sometimes. I say that in all sincerity. Stupidity for young people is really good because you don't know what you can't do.
Right.
You know? And so you do it and you get it done. And so that was a good thing. So then fast forward a couple of years. So now, the CMA Awards is on ABC. I had been up to that point the chairman of the TV committee. The CMA decided to move me out of the chairmanship of the TV committee, and they put me on as a producer working under Walter for the CMA Awards, which was great. It was awesome. And I loved it. So my job was really kind of putting together the creative for the bands, for the artists, working with Walter, what each song would look like, perform like, and interacting with the artists, which was great because I knew all the artists. I'd already worked with them on music videos.
Right.
So they were already comfortable with me. And so, you know what, honestly, it was great, and it was a great gig. And I loved doing it, and I loved working with Walter. And then after a couple of years of doing that, you know, Walter decided that he wanted to step down. I mean, he'd been doing it for 35 years, you know, but he didn't want to completely just walk away. So they brought me in. So I had to go to LA. That was a moment. I had to go to LA to a board meeting. I wasn't on the board anymore, but they asked me to come out. CMA did. And they, after one of the meetings, they asked me, they said, "Hey, we need you to come in this room for a minute. We need to talk to you." So I go into the room, and there's like the head of ABC, Walter, and they're all sitting there looking at me. You know how you walk in the room and you can feel like there's something on in the room? And I'm like,
right.
I'm like, "Oh my God, I'm getting fired." I'm like, "Oh my God, this seems like really." And so they explained to what, you know, what they wanted to do was that they wanted me to move into executive producer role for the awards, with Walter staying on as my mentor and to help guide me and be my someone that I could lean on. And, you know, Walter is the best television producer of all time. You know, I mean, and he and I had such a great relationship. We'd already been working together. I'd already been the chairman of the TV committee for like, I don't know, 6-7 years. So we already had a great working relationship. And so he did that with me for like, I don't know, 4 years, 5 years, something like that, which was great. Because I had the wisdom of, you know, sometimes when I would get all crazy and upset, want to go, "Well, just forget it," you know, you know, being young, stupid. And Walter would be like, "Okay, I think you need to think about this before you make that call. You
right.
know, you know, don't make that call today. Why don't you sleep on that?" Just little things like that. Just, you know, Walter was, you know, Walter, like 1 year, for example, I was so upset because we just ran. It was the 50th. That's what it was. The 50th. And we just ran off the tracks with time. I mean, I think it was, you know, my wife said it. She was like, after that open that you put together.
Oh,
you know,
it was iconic. It was incredible, that opening.
Thank you. She goes, "You know what? It was, people were just there to enjoy themselves. They were so in the spirit. Because it was like, you know, people, it was taking people full 60 seconds to get on stage after they won the award. They're hugging everybody, and I'm like going, I mean, we are off the rails, because I was so far over in time. I mean, I think we ended up going at least 15 minutes over. And, I mean, I got a call from the network going, if you're not over, you know, I think it was like 10:30, if you're not, we're cutting out of you. I'm like, "Oh my gosh." And you know what? We had already been, we went into the show with their permission going like 12 minutes over, which was fine because it was, you know, the 50th. And I was so upset after the show. And everybody wanted to revel in the, you know, of the night. And someone came to me and said, you're over. It's okay." But I was so upset because Walter had taught me Walter taught me how to be a producer. And it's a badge of honor to not go over. Like, a lot of people don't think of it that way anymore. But Walter taught me how to do this job. And if you're showing a side of professionalism to end on time. You know,
looking back, how would you have approached that differently?
Well, I think probably I would have gone in going, "Hey, we just need to make it three and a half hours, because there's nothing to cut." I mean, honestly, what I think I would have done was, looking back, I think that I think we would have done every single performance would have been about the 50th. You know, whereas what we tried to do was interlace the show with the 50th, but still have certain artists do their current songs and things like that. I think that if we would have done it all over again, that maybe what we should have done was just from beginning to end, it's all about, you know, the history and the 50th and all of that. But I think when you're trying to do 50 years in 3 hours, I think we've just gone, you know what, it's going to be a 3.5-hour show. You know, it's making a 3.5-hour show. Because it wasn't like anybody was ready to go home.
Right.
I mean, they weren't. I mean, they just weren't, you know. And remember, we were up against the highest-rated baseball game of all time.
It was the Cubs World Series, and you guys only lost, like, 3 ratings points. Or I mean, it was insane.
Yeah. It was crazy that we all – I just felt like nobody's going to watch the show, you know. But, you know, there's been there's been a bunch of things on the CMA Awards that – for me have been moments that I'm just proud to just even be a part of. And that was definitely, that open was, I mean, I will tell you, that was, so we're live. And by the way, we never got through the open completely in dress rehearsal. I mean, not one time, not in rehearsal, never did we get through the entire medley. The only time we got through it the entire way without stopping was the one time, and that was live. So, you know, now talking about pressure, on that one I did feel pressure, because you got to remember, you go back and you think about the six-year-old that's on his dad's show in Wilmington, North Carolina, and these are my heroes, and I got to meet them all when I was 6 years old. And I got to be around them, and I got to, you know, like even people that people won't even remember that are members of the Grand Ole Opry. I remember Ray Pillow opening up his guitar case in a high school one time because they were in North Carolina because they were doing the show from this high school. And it was like this gold inlay in his guitar case. And I'd never seen anything like it, you know. Like, and these people, they were my heroes. And so, I'm sitting there, and I remember that six-year-old kid that just loved all of this.
Right.
And I put together the 50th. And I, you know, Brad Paisley and I put together that medley together, he and I. I went out, both of us on guitars, and singing, and I'm singing Dolly's part, and he's singing this. And we got through with the open, and I busted out crying. I mean, I was at my producer's table just crying because I did it. I did it. You know, I did exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to move to Nashville. I wanted to work in this industry. I wanted to work with these artists and be a part of this community and I don't know how big of a part. I just want to be a part of it. And then I wanted to honor it, and so that was the moment for me. That was the big moment. So, and then the other, you know, there's two other moments that I look back and I go, I'm so proud to have been a part of it. And that was the Glenn Campbell tribute
with Keith, Brad, and Vince Gill.
Vince Gill, I was just honored to be a part of all that. And then the open that we did for all the women in country music, you know. And for me, the moment for me was I was rehearsing on stage. This wasn't even the live part, but the moment for me was we were rehearsing on stage, and my assistant come to me and said, "Hey, the ladies, the women want to see you." In the backstage, in the dressing room. And all of them were in there. They were rehearsing the song together, and they had a little cassette player, you know. They had a little, probably not a cassette. It was probably a CD. that's something they were playing back on. So they were rehearsing it, and when I walked in the room, it was, and somebody told me later, it was like, that was such a moment to see what transpired. They did not stop rehearsing, but each one of them got up out of their chair and came over and gave me a hug. And they're all thanking me for, thank you for having me. I'm like, first of all, that they would do that, but I kept having going, you don't thank me, you deserve to be here. This, you know, but seeing that, and then when I realized, well, wait a minute, I won the CMA Award with Martina, Independence Day. I did Terry Clark's videos. I did Dolly's. I did Reba McEntire videos. I did, Sarah Evans' first video. Jennifer Nettles was the host of my Christmas show. You know, and so, I mean, the only one that I hadn't worked with was Crystal Gayle. And so I'm like going, that's when I realized, oh my gosh, these women have given me the best times of my life. And, the best moments of my life was being on set with them and shooting music videos, or Jennifer Nettles and I coming up with the open for the Christmas show. And so that was that year. That was my moment that I loved being a part of.
By the way, your openings are always iconic, and then the monologues are always great. What I think is kind of funny about award shows is that pretty much all award shows, usually the opening is not when the most people are watching, right? It's usually, correct me if I'm wrong, it's more in the middle, or you cross the first hour, and that's when it picks up steam. Do you think about that as you're putting these massive openings together and going, oh my God, this isn't even the most watched section of the show?
Well, try to tone, with what we're doing. The year that we opened with Hold My Hand with Darius Rucker, it was just right. It was just, I'd never asked Darius to ever do a Hootie song, ever. You know, I was not going to do that. When he first came in the country format, I knew he was, all the other producers were asking him to do Hootie songs on their TV shows, but I just was not going to do it. I just respected him too much as an artist and a musician to do that. But when, on that year, with everything that had gone, that had transpired, I just felt like that we needed some unity, that people needed to come together, black and white, whatever nationality you are, whether you're African-American or wherever you come from, that we just needed to, do what that song said. And so I always try to set the tone of what the night's going to be with the open. And I give a lot of thought to the open. And here's my feeling, too, is that, my thing is, like, if you can create a great open, it takes the audience through the rest of the show. And I'm not talking about necessarily at that point the television audience. I'm talking about the audience in the room. Because if the audience in the room loves your open, then they're going to laugh at your jokes in the monologue. And if they laugh at your jokes in the monologue, that comes through on TV. And just the overall nature of, again, the first five rows that are sitting there, they're going to determine whether the show is successful or not. Because if you got great cutaways of Faith and Tim laughing about, the Barbie dolls or whatever it is, that's going to transpire into the television viewing audience, and then you're going to be successful.
Well, I feel like we could go on forever and probably do, six podcasts on this. I mean, I guess I'll just, there's no clean way to wrap it up because there's so much we could talk about, but I'm just curious, any moments that could have been a total disaster that you saved, or maybe something that was a total disaster that at home we had no idea about, any CMA Easter eggs that if we go back and watch, we go, oh my God, that's it. Look at that.
Well, you know, so, you know, knock on wood, so far we haven't had that, you know, on the CMA Awards. We haven't had, you know, an artist start over or a mic go out or, you know, we will. I mean, it's going to happen eventually, but that's what live TV is. You know, there was a couple of times, you know, that people, when we had the mosh pit, there were a couple of artists that almost fell into the mosh pit. There was actually one songwriter that won the award, and he fell in. I think he did fall into the mosh pit. Now, the Billboard Music Awards, we've had many times, several times, that artists, like, were like 30 seconds from coming back from commercial, and that they're still not on stage, you know, getting ready to perform. You know, it'd be like, there's been several times where I'm almost like going, calling New York to put in another commercial because we don't know where the artist is. But we still haven't had to do that. We barely made it, you know. So, but yeah, but it'll happen, you know, it will for sure. Something will happen someday, that's for sure.
Well, this has been such a thrill. Thank you so much for taking the time. It's always great talking with you. Actually, I'm also curious, as we're all stuck inside, you're the music guy, you're the movie guy, you're the TV guy. Any content you're consuming right now that you think everyone else should check out?
Well, I thought that Waco was incredible. I don't know if you've seen that on Netflix.
It's on my list. I have to get to it.
That was pretty amazing. The acting in that was quite incredible.
Julia Garner, isn't it, right?
Yeah, that was really, really good. And then, you know, I've enjoyed watching some of these, like I've enjoyed watching Keith, you know, with what he comes up with, Keith Urban. I thought that he's just, again, kid is just the best. I mean, he's just so awesome. And so I've enjoyed seeing what some of these artists are doing as far as what, you know, how they're incorporating their time. And I know there's some other things on that. I mean, you know what? I've watched just about everything on Netflix. It seems like there is to watch. So now I've gone back into the old stuff. Like I watched some Alfred Hitchcock movies over the weekend.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I watched North by Northwest yesterday. So that was fun. But hopefully everybody will stay safe and hopefully we'll all get past this and we can all see live music again soon.
Absolutely. And is there anything else? I mean, the CMAs you've got going on, is there anything else that you're trying to accomplish? You're now managing a band. I know from talking with you that you've always wanted to produce some version of West Side Story. Is there anything else coming up that you want to check off?
Yeah, no, it hurts my heart that Steven Spielberg is doing West Side Story. Ah. That's for sure. So, I got a musical that I'm working on. I'd love to. I've been working, especially during this downtime. I've been working on that, and then. The other thing that we're doing is I have a series that I'm getting ready to pitch that is set in the country music world, actually, the script is done, the pilot script is done. And so hopefully, we can all get through with all of this and I can be out pitching that soon. But those the scripted world is what I'm kind of, you know, you know what? Because here's the thing. I'm exactly where I want to be in the music world. You know, I love my two shows. I love the CMA Awards. And I love doing the Christmas show and the festival. And then once a year, I get to go over on the pop side and do the Billboard Music Awards. So I love that. And I'm not looking to do any more other than that. What I'm looking to do is different, something different. And that's that's something in the scripted world. So that's what I'm working on at this point.
Are you writing the musical or you're helping produce it?
I am actually writing it, and I got someone else doing the music. And then the other script, the drama that I'm working is, I wrote the treatment on it, and I got a writer to write it. So, yeah, I'm involved in the whole script part of it as well. So, yeah, just, you know what, again, just trying to evolve and just figure out what's next. Don't sit still. Don't sit still.
Absolutely. Well, again, thank you so much. I mean, whenever I think about you from, you know, the various times we connect and, you know, grab lunch or whatever it is, I always leave that lunch thinking, my God, I mean, that guy is Nashville. Like, there are certain people that you just can't picture the town without, and they're just so involved, so integrated. And, you know, thank you. I know even in times like this, I can't imagine how busy you keep your schedule. So thank you for taking the time, and hope we get the chance to do it again soon.
Great. You're so kind to say so. I appreciate it so much. Thank you. It's been great today.
Drive safe, and hope to see you whenever we get out of here.
Okay. Sounds good. See you later.
Talk soon. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in, and thanks again to Robert for taking the time to talk. It was such a thrill, and I hope we get the chance to do it again soon. Next week, we have an incredibly historical interview with Del Bryant, the son of Boudlow and Felice Bryant, who were the first professional songwriters in Nashville. I swear, you can't make this up. Together, they sold over 500 million records and wrote songs for artists like the Everly Brothers, Buddy Holly, Lil Jimmy Dickens, Emmylou Harris, and so many more. I learned so much from this interview, I can't wait for you guys to hear. The Zach Kuhn Show is mixed by Sam Heyman, and our theme music is by Justin Johnson. If you want more content from us, you can subscribe to our newsletter at nashvillebriefing.com. And you can also follow us on socials, everything at Nashville Briefing. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye.